How much power should be vested in the commander-in-chief?
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
The decider? Whatever happened to checks and balances?
This administration seems to forget there is a law they have to obey.
No opportunity to challenge a law has gone without that law being challenged.
Today on A World of Possibilities, the great decider, the unchecked rise of presidential power. What happens to the delicate balance between branches of government when the White House dominates a compliant Congress?
If you go back 2,000 years, you see that Rome believed that it was the great exception, that it was unique. Then the British, and they were unique, and they were going to bring British civilization to the world. Now here we are, and we're unique too. And the unfortunate thing is that history doesn't support the notion that any of these nations have been unique. They didn't last beyond their trajectory.
And what's this presidency's current trajectory? Let's see, approval ratings at historic lows, record deficits, a splintering party base, wars, controversies over corruption, spying, and immigration, and an unprecedented hostility from abroad. Yet the power of the office keeps growing.
I think people are running away from the king right now. He's a sinking ship at this point.
My name is Mark Sommer. Join us as we examine the shifting balance of power between the presidency, Congress, the media, and the people, and its implications for the future of this country's long-running democratic experiment. Welcome to A World of Possibilities. So, what do you think? Does the president have too much power, not enough, or just the right amount? Should the president wield the authority to wage war without the consent of Congress? What limits, if any, should be placed on executive authority? Today we'll consult with presidential historians, a legendary White House journalist, constitutional scholars, and others who've closely observed the ever-shifting balance between presidents, congresses, the media, and the public. But first let's go to the streets of two all-American cities, Columbus, Ohio, my hometown, with radio producer Mike Foley, and Laramie, Wyoming, with radio producer Kristen Espeland, to find out what some heartland Americans think about presidential power.
Does the president himself have too much power right now, do you think? Not enough or just the right amount?
I do think he has a little bit too much power, but I don't think that that's, I think that's our fault for not standing up and allowing that to happen.
He got all the power, but he got too much and he don't know how to use it.
I'm concerned about some of the programs, the domestic surveillance programs, the apparent circumvention of established procedures and protocols for conducting searches. And in that regard, I guess I am genuinely concerned about the president's power.
I think he has too much power because he's actually just eliminating our rights as American citizens. I mean, we can't even burn a flag anymore. Not necessarily that I wanted to, but that's my right as an American to be able to burn that flag, you know? And it's my right as an American to have private phone conversations and not have the phone tapped and not be paranoid about terrorism and all this stuff. Because, I mean, it's all over oil. I mean, it's just so obvious. I mean, you don't even have to follow the news every day to be able to figure that one out. It's ridiculous.
In your view, does the president have too much power, not enough power, or just the right amount?
I think he has too much power. I think he abuses the amount of power that he has. I think he goes over his limit.
It's been said many times that we have the most powerful executive in the world. And when we look at these other smaller countries that model themselves after us, we can see that the executive usually abuses that power. And I think that's happening now.
How do you feel about the balance of power between President, Congress, and the Supreme Court?
Well, it doesn't seem like the balance of power that I remember learning about in elementary school.
But opinion is not unanimous, not by any means. Though the great majority of those we talked with on the streets think the current administration has taken too much power, some aren't bothered by it at all.
I think there is a proper balance between the branches of government. I know that there are a lot of people that feel that Bush has too much power at the present time, but I don't feel that way at all.
You just kind of answered this next question, but I was going to ask you, does the president have too much, not enough, or just the right amount of power, and why do you think that?
Actually, I do wish that the president had a little bit more power, because I'm very much in favor of a line veto. I just think there's way too much power given to the legislators, and that there should be a line veto.
I don't have a problem with the amount of power that the president has. I have a problem with the way the president uses it.
We'll never have too much power because we've set it up so that he or she cannot hang on to an abuse of power for very long. Right now, I would say this president as an individual is pushing the envelope, but I don't think that the envelope will break. There's a system of accountability, and people go to the polls to exercise their rights.
Now 86 years old and a journalist in the nation's capital since the age of 19, Helen Thomas has asked many questions of many presidents. A UPI reporter for a record 57 years, from 1943 to the year 2000, Helen covered 9 presidents as a White House correspondent. She's the author of the book, Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President, Wit and Wisdom from the Front Row at the White House. A feisty and loquacious journalist, for decades Helen occupied the front row seat of honor at press briefings as the doyenne of the White House press corps, till one day when her always impertinent questions rattled the president's press secretary one too many times, and she was peremptorily placed in the back of the room. Not till March 2006 did the president call on Helen again. Ever the inquisitor, Helen demanded to know why he'd gone into Iraq. After half-answering her question, the president admitted that he half-regretted letting her ask it. The same question arose again when comedian Stephen Colbert aired a now-famous mock audition tape at the traditional Roast and Toast White House Correspondents Association dinner in May 2006, featuring Helen stalking a besieged Colbert out of the White House briefing room into an underground parking garage all the way to Manhattan, where, relieved to be rid of her, Colbert discovered her driving the cab he entered to complete his great escape. We caught up with the irreverent and irrepressible Helen Thomas in her office in downtown Washington, a few blocks from the White House. Do you see a kind of authoritarianism beginning to emerge in American politics, and do you see it as something that's specifically in this administration or something that's been growing over time, if you think it's happening?
I see it specifically in this administration, of a real secretive administration and a power grab, where they don't even think they have to obey the law, that is the president. Wiretapping, when he could go get a court warrant and just bypasses the law, when it was really not a crisis, because most courts are very lenient if there's true emergency to our country, and he insists that he doesn't need it, that he has inherent powers as commander-in-chief, this is baloney. You know, these are things that American people have to watch for. And the signing statements, he signed the anti-torture amendment. At the same time, he wrote a signing statement saying he didn't have to obey it. He's supposed to enforce the law. That's his role in government. Congress enacts the laws.
You've watched up close and reported on about 9 U.S. presidents. How does the Bush administration's concentration of power compare with previous administrations?
Well, obviously, Nixon went too far, and he's the only president in American history to be forced to resign for bypassing the law and for not telling the total truth and using all the levers of power to try to use an abuse of government power. And I think in a democracy, this catches up, hopefully and fortunately, for leaders who do try to overstep their bounds. I think this administration seems to forget there is a law they have to obey. This president and every president takes the oath to uphold the laws of the Constitution. And when they default on that, they have enough of a transparency in a democracy that they are found out. Eventually, the people finally realize that their rights are being taken away.
Do you see that criticism now coming from across the political spectrum, or primarily still from Democrats and liberals?
No, I think Republicans are beginning to wake up and they're being ashamed. They never believe in the federal incursion of our privacy anyway. It is just a question of being a Democrat or Republican. This is our individual rights as human beings, as Americans.
When you're in the White House press room now and you see these briefings Do they have a different tone to them than they did? Does the press corps have a different role now, and does it act differently than it did, say, in the first few years after 2001?
They're coming out of their coma, finally. I thought they defaulted on their role, which was to be totally skeptical when information is offered without proof.
How did Presidents Johnson and Nixon take your sharp questioning by comparison to George Bush?
Well, they didn't like it, obviously. Nobody wants to be probed like that. But I feel I had one chance in the barrel, and I should ask the questions.
Helen, sometimes your questioning has been compared to acupuncture.
I hope so.
So you're into these exotic oriental remedies for presidents?
I think they should always be accountable. I think they should have to explain what they do, and mostly they have to explain when they take a country into war. 3 years into war and can't say why, and every reason you've given has proved to be untrue. Who are we?
Would it be an altogether a bad thing if the American imperial project, America as an empire, failed, and like Britain, we were forced to return to living more within our own borders and our own means?
Yes, it would be bad, because I think we are people who can spread good standards, good principles, good ethics. We've represented the best that mankind can aspire to, and we were moving forward. So I think I still want us to be the beacon light of freedom and symbolic, and I don't see why we have to retreat. We just have to amend our ways.
So you think there is a very important global role for the United States, but how can it use its power in what you view as a more constructive way?
Pull the troops out of Iraq tomorrow and all the other places where we're trying to buy the oil. Do the things, spread the goodwill that we did in the past, what we were really known for, why everybody wants to immigrate here, because we represented the best. Let's get back to what we really are and what we were.
What's the last time when you could admire the man in the Oval Office?
Well, my favorites. I admired Carter very much for putting human rights as the centerpiece of his foreign policy. I think that in many ways, Clinton did try to work for peace in Balkans, Middle East, Northern Ireland. Of course, Kennedy was my favorite because he was most inspired. He thought we could reach for the stars. He signed the first nuclear test ban treaty. He said we were going to land men on the moon, and we did it, even though he didn't live to see it. He created the Peace Corps. He did so many things that he showed he knew the difference between war and peace. And he knew well enough to show statesmanship along with Nikita Khrushchev at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He stepped back from the brink. Each one knew they could blow up the world with their nuclear arsenals, and each one was being pushed by their military to go for broke. And they had more sense. They cared about humanity. I like Johnson's domestic side, the Great Society, what he did in the first 2 years of his service, serving out the Kennedy term, that where he really made a contribution, Medicare, Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time in the South, federal aid to education at all levels, from Head Start through college, child maternal health, national parks, public housing, caring for your fellow man. We are our brother's keeper.
Helen, you've been...
Aren't you tired of my clichés?
No! you say them with such heart, Helen. They sound all new to me. Now, tell me this. Is there inevitably a certain kind of insulation or... as they look out across the country, is it very difficult to, in your view, for them to retain a connection with the people that they supposedly represent?
I think they get pretty autocratic when they go into the Oval Office. I'm the decider. I decide what's best. They become pretty arrogant.
And you found that to be true with even with some of the presidents like Johnson and...
Oh, yeah. And that said, but some of them did some soul searching, and they knew that wasn't true. And they made that they had some sort of remorse.
Who are you thinking of?
Lyndon Johnson, for one thing, I'm sure that he knew he was wrong, on the wrong track in Vietnam.
But he didn't feel he could change in midst.
Hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? He had to hear that everywhere he went in his, you know, the last years of his office. And, you know, the reality sets in for some of them.
Veteran White House journalist Helen Thomas. In a moment, Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe on how presidential power has expanded through the use of a tool more potent than the veto, signing statements. As we enter this short break, let's listen again to public views on presidential power from the streets of Columbus and Laramie.
Should the president have the power to wage war without the authority of Congress?
No, of course not. That man doesn't know what it's like to fight in a war. He's just some rich, spoiled kid, and he just wants to recruit all these soldiers to go running around with their big guns, and he has no idea what it means.
Do you think that there is a proper balance of power between the three branches of government?
Well, I don't think there is, but I think Congress is partly to blame. They abdicated the power.
We've abandoned the Constitution, I think, in the last generation. And I think if we just went back to what the Constitution says and goes, then everything would be fine.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
I know my red phone. I can't just call up Putin. I didn't like the guy anyway. He was too damn highfalutin. Let's go for wheeling down on my ranch. Wait right here. We'll go shooting all the cans from the fences I could never mend. To the young man I had to send, I couldn't look them in the eye and have to say, it's a better world. Who cares if it's a lie? As long as your flag unfurls.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. To hear the podcast of this program and to access our show archives, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com or visit iTunes.
So what exactly is a signing statement? Unlike a veto, a president can use a signing statement to modify or nullify a law already passed by Congress. This president has used signing statements some 750 times in the past 5 years, including one to void an explicit congressional prohibition of the use of torture on enemy combatants.
We cannot let terrorists and rogue nations hold this nation hostile or hold our allies hostile.
We turn now to Boston Globe staff reporter Charlie Savage, the journalist who first revealed the Bush administration's practice of using signing statements on a massive scale to overrule the will of Congress.
What was the question? It was about emergencies, wasn't it?
No opportunity to challenge a law has gone without that law being challenged. And the number, therefore, of challenged statutes has absolutely crushed all previous records.
Now, you have written that President Bush has never vetoed a bill. On the one hand, that would seem to say that he's accepting the will of Congress. But you say that that actually doesn't give Congress the chance to override his judgments because he can then issue a signing statement that no one notices. Tell us more about how the veto being not exercised actually gives him more power.
He is the first president in modern history not to use a veto. He's the first since Thomas Jefferson to stay this long in office without using a veto. Bush and his legal team have used the signing statement as a way to nullify sections of bills which they do not like while keeping the rest. One realizes that if the signing statement works, Bush has figured out a way to take out legislation with which he disagrees, which is more powerful than the veto which the Constitution actually gives him for several reasons. First of all, when you veto something, everyone pays attention to that, and you have to take the political heat for it. Secondly, when you veto something using the constitutional veto, Congress has a chance to override the veto. Therefore, there's a check on this power to take out legislation. By using a signing statement is essentially a unilateral final word on what's going to count and what might as well not have been in the bill in the first place. A third way is that under the constitutional veto, you have to take the entire bill or get rid of the entire bill. And sometimes you don't want to get rid of the entire bill if you're the president. This allows you in a line item way to take out things. So in all these respects, a signing statement is much more powerful than a veto. And President Bush's extraordinary use of signing statements helps illuminate why he's abandoned his veto power.
When a president essentially nullifies or sort of secretly or privately amends legislation that has been passed in this way, how do we know what the law then is?
Well, this is one of the problems that critics of this practice have identified, which is, to some extent, you want a president to not enforce a law which is blatantly unconstitutional. It's one of the safeguards in the system. But President Bush, who has used this power, or this asserted power, so much more frequently than anyone before him, and has used it to advance legal claims which are in dispute, or in some cases seem to actually conflict with existing Supreme Court precedents, has demonstrated a pervasive challenge to the concept that the laws mean what they say, and that the executive branch has a duty to enforce the laws. And by doing so, he's not only cast doubt on what these new laws that were enacted under his tenure really mean or don't mean, but he's also called into question or put a cloud over numerous other statutes that have been on the books since before he took office, so he did not have an opportunity to issue an assigning statement on them. Because many other laws look a lot like these new laws in form and might be vulnerable to the same sort of constitutional arguments that he's mustering. Therefore, you can't be sure what laws he thinks are valid and what laws he thinks are simply advice that Congress has offered him rather than mandates for things he must follow. And that undermines the very idea of the rule of law.
Charlie Savage, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. The U.S. Constitution does not mention executive privilege, though every president since George Washington has utilized and reinterpreted the right of the executive branch to withhold documents and information from both the public and other branches of government. Under President George W. Bush, however, the concept of executive privilege has been greatly expanded to claim permanent secrecy for many formerly public records, including presidential papers that document the decision-making process. So how much secrecy is appropriate, and how much is too much? Joining us now is Mark Rozelle, professor of public policy at George Mason University. He's testified before Congress and written extensively about executive privilege and its implications for the power of the presidency. Mark Rozelle joins us now from his office at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia.
What we today refer to as executive privilege is a presidential power that's been in existence since the very beginning of the Republic. In other words, presidents going back to George Washington have exercised some form of what we today call executive privilege. That just wasn't the phrase that was in common usage at the time.
And what is the usual justification for that executive privilege? Is it often related to national security questions?
Very frequently, claims of executive privilege pertain to national security. But what I find very interesting is that in the modern era, some presidents have just thrown the phrase national security out there as a sole justification for withholding information, as though if you say the words national security, that trumps any other consideration. I would not argue that there is a unique quality for national security issues that provide for them a higher justification for a presidential exercise of executive privilege than, say, a domestic policy matter.
Once a president declares that something needs to be withheld due to national security considerations or claims executive privilege, what redress does either the public or the Congress have to still be able to obtain such documents?
Yeah. Well, that's the key question, because a president may claim executive privilege, but a congressional committee that wants to investigate the White House will say that in order to carry out its constitutional functions, it must have access to information or testimony from White House aides. And the Congress at that point can decide whether to challenge the president. And what it has at its disposal is a variety of weapons, a threat to hold members of the administration in contempt, to issue subpoenas, to hold up support for administration-favored programs until the administration is forthcoming with information. I think if you look at the Constitution and the powers that Congress already has, it has plenty of ammunition it could use to get information from the president. As far as the public's concerned, it's the court of public opinion. If the president is withholding information and it's highly unpopular and the public is putting a lot of pressure on the president may be persuaded to turn over information simply because there's a political cost to continuing to claim executive privilege.
Have we seen it in relation to the more recent controversy over domestic spying? Has there been a certain amount of claim of executive privilege in that regard?
I don't think that they've uttered the phrase executive privilege in that case, so I would not put that in the category of an executive privilege controversy per se, but it falls under the broader umbrella of presidential secrecy, of course.
It seems like executive privilege is basically executive secrecy. Is that correct?
Executive privilege is one form of executive branch secrecy, but because executive privilege is a legal term today, it does connote a specific form of secrecy, in effect. And generally, what it means is that the president himself has the right to withhold information, to withhold testimony, to withhold documents from congressional committees or from the judicial branch when the president thinks it is in the public interest to do so, that releasing such information would damage the public interest in some tangible way. And also, when the president wants to protect internal deliberations within the White House or protect the integrity of ongoing criminal investigations in the Department of Justice.
With the trends going, it appears mostly in the direction of greater executive privilege. Do you see this trend reversing itself in the future? For example, if one House of Congress changes hands in a new election?
Well, I think if there were a partisan change in Congress in the next couple of years, there would be a very significant difference on issues pertaining to executive privilege. You would see a much more aggressive action by, for example, the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee in reviewing presidential decision-making in areas where claims of executive privilege are germane. I think if the opposite party were in power, of course, you would have a lot more investigating taking place and a lot more challenges to the administration's claims to having a right to secrecy.
It's interesting. From what you say, it sounds like it's not necessarily one party or the other. It's unitary government where both the legislative branch and the executive branch are held by one party, and then you tend towards this greater ability to sustain a claim of executive privilege.
Well, I think that's right, and I believe that's a little bit of a sad commentary on our system because the constitutional framers created this system of separated powers with the belief that each branch would very jealously and vigorously protect its own prerogatives against encroachments by any other branch of government, and that this would be done without regard to partisan considerations, just defending one's own institution and its legitimate constitutional power should trump partisanship. But that doesn't happen in the modern era, and so when you have one party controlling both houses and also controlling the presidency, and the president is making elaborate claims of executive privilege, for example, you're not going to see a vigorous challenge by Congress of the president's actions.
Mark Rozelle, professor of public policy at George Mason University. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network. Let's turn once again to street wisdom from publics in Columbus, Ohio, and Laramie, Wyoming.
Do you think the president has too much power, or just enough, or not enough?
I think in a lot of cases he has too much power. Being able to move the military anywhere he wants, anytime he wants, and he's done it. So, yeah, it's probably a little bit too much power.
I don't really think it's a matter of how much power the authorities should have. I think it should be how much power the people have. Because in a perfect world, democracy would not be like this. You know, I think it's just going to be a dictatorship or anarchy.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me.
Take a walk with me.
Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who pray for a night before you go to sleep. What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud?
This is A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. If you wish to contact us, please direct emails to comments@aworldofpossibilities.com. This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
Dear Mr. President, you'd never take a walk with me.
I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities. This program, The Great Decider, The Unchecked Rise of Presidential Power, is underwritten by the Ford Foundation. Coming up in this half hour, we'll speak with presidential scholar James Thurber. But first we turn to veteran political analyst Kevin Phillips, a strategist whose 1969 book, The Emerging Republican Majority, is credited with having charted the party's path to dominance in succeeding decades. Phillips' political commentaries in books and articles have often been required reading for both parties. That's why his recent criticism of the Bush administration and his re-registration as a political independent have created such shockwaves across the political spectrum. Author most recently of American Theocracy and American Dynasty, he's currently a commentator for National Public Radio and the Los Angeles Times and a contributor to Time and Harper's. Kevin Phillips joins us now from his home in Connecticut.
I think it's a very dangerous period for the United States, the 2010s and the 2020s and the 2030s, and I think the first two decades will tell more of the story. It's going to be very hard for the United States to continue to pay for importing as much fuel and as many manufactured goods as we do. It's going to be awfully hard to maintain the power of the dollar, and we have a leadership elite that lives in a kind of unilateralist slash biblical netherworld, really. They think you can do these things unilaterally, and they have lurking in the back of their minds at least a sense of a religious constituency that wants to fulfill that side, too. And if you're thinking about all those things, if you've got this odd mix of isolationism and fundamentalism, you're not going to be preparing the country for the future in the sober way that would be necessary.
Once the executive gains certain powers, how hard will it be to take them away again? Does the American system possess a kind of self-balancing dynamic that tends to pull us away from extremes in the end, or are we capable of really running off the rails here?
Well, I think we're capable of going off the rails. I don't think running could be too great a description, because there were reasons after 9/11, enormous stresses. I have a lot of trouble seeing an administration elected in 2008 being able to turn around enough of these circumstances to make Americans feel that they're back on the right track. And in that sense, if stress continues to be there, and if the terrorists decide that they really want the United States to be in this kind of psyched-out vein in which it frets and it borrows money and it spends money it doesn't have and it becomes a leading world debtor and it tries to play a full-fledged great imperial power when it can no longer really do so, if I were a bin Laden, that's exactly what I'd want. I'd want a president that pursued all of that as opposed to one that wanted to retrench and rebuild. And it's just possible that anybody thinking in those terms would want to create a climate in which something resembling the right got another booster shot so it could be returned to power, because I don't think we're mobilizing under this administration. I think in a larger way we're demobilizing.
What explains the strange alliance between right-wing evangelical Christians and Orthodox Jews when Christian theology is based on the ultimate conversion or annihilation of Jews once they return to the Holy Land?
I think one of the ironies here, and it's not necessarily an irony, it's a very Machiavellian nuance, is that the Christian right and the Jewish right in Israel, they have a major overlap, but they have major divisions because theologically it doesn't work out the same for everybody. And I think they're each a little mindful of this, and sometimes maybe there's a strained alliance, but essentially it's a biblical axis. They have the same preliminary goals, which is to take the book of Revelation. I have to explain here by saying that the people that Tim LaHaye and others who write about the end times develop quite a theology here, and their theology rests on a whole biblical unfolding that involves both Jews and Christians. But with the Christians, you have everything from the rapture, from the end times, and Armageddon in Jewish theology, and I probably won't get this quite right, but there are other things that happen in terms of the destruction of the temple on the mount and how everything comes together around Jerusalem. Now, they all favor the preliminary unfoldings together, as far as I can tell. Maybe some of the secular Jews are a little more cynical about this and just figure they're using both of the other sides to get support for a geopolitics. But I think that the Christian right and the Jewish fundamentalist right in Israel both look on Israel as the promised land and as the agent of God in these last important hours. And that's a very unusual bond to have in foreign policy.
It is, and it seems to be hugely influential. Stephen Walt of the Kennedy School at Harvard and John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, two very well-respected political scientists, recently wrote an essay in the London Review of Books that became highly controversial as soon as it was published, called The Israeli Lobby. It warned of undue influence on U.S. policy by an unrepresentative minority of pro-Israeli Jews and right-wing Christians. Why would politicians like Tom DeLay, with no known affinity for Judaism as a religion, forge common cause with the agenda of the Likud and other far-right Israeli political elements?
Well, because his view of the stakes in the Middle East were very biblical, and he saw the West Bank as not as the West Bank, but as the old Israeli provinces of Judea and Samaria, and took it all very seriously.
Do you actually, you believe that people like Tom DeLay actually do believe this biblical prophecy, and they're not simply using it as a kind of political gambit?
I think they believe it. There may be occasions on which they use elements of it for politics, and I'm sure some of their aides who don't believe it can be pretty cynical. But basically, I would say that both Bush and DeLay believe a lot of these things.
Ronald Reagan spoke of mourning in America when he came into office, and it had a great resonance for many people. Now it doesn't seem like mourning in America anymore. Where's the basis for renewed self-confidence that would not just be a rhetorical wishful thinking, but a realistic appraisal of our assets and liabilities?
It's hard for me to see one. Ronald Reagan spoke about mourning again in America. Bob Dole in 1988 made the observation that it was high noon in America. And, you know, at this point, we may be at a stage in 4 or 5 or 6 years that we're starting to think it's twilight if things don't turn around. Some people thought it was twilight right at the end of the 80s with the rise of Japan, and that turned out to be a false card. But I think China's far more likely to fulfill the yardsticks of a major rival for global leadership in the next quarter century.
The last sentence of your book, American Theocracy, you say, for those of us who grew up thinking that the United States was different, the prospect that it probably is not different is a chastening one. Do you mean that the notion of an exceptionalist America, that is to say the United States as a city upon the hill or a light unto all nations, is actually an illusion?
If you go back 2,000 years, you see that Rome believed that it was a great exception, that it was unique. Then the Spanish under the Habsburgs believed that they were, and they had the Inquisition and the Armada and the religious wars and the Counter-Reformation in Europe. Then the Dutch believed they were unique. Then the British, and they were unique, and they were going to bring British civilization to the world. Now here we are, and we're unique too. And the unfortunate thing is that history doesn't support the notion that any of these nations have been unique. They might have been different, but they were transient, and they didn't last beyond their trajectory. So they, in that sense, they weren't different.
Kevin Phillips, author of American Theocracy. We'll be back in a moment with presidential scholar James Thurber. But first, let's hear more from the middle American streets of Columbus, Ohio, and Laramie, Wyoming.
Well, he kind of bullied everyone into going to war, and the Patriot Act is part of his having too much power. He ran that through in the Iraq War thing.
Our nation is built on a fundamental system of checks and balances, and the checks and balances work best when there is what I would call the competition of ideas. And my observation is that that competition is all but ended, and right now we are in a bit of a one-sided conversation, and one-sided conversations are never that much fun.
It's nice.
It's nice.
It's good.
It's good.
When you live like you should.
When you live like you should.
It's a peaceful
in
harmony.
Washington,
stop changing the words.
And with me, it's the White House.
Alvin!
This is A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. Copies of this program are available on CD and can be requested by email at comments@aworldofpossibilities.com.
Mr. President, will you and your cabinet kindly sing?
So where does the current occupant of the White House stand in relation to other presidents in his exercise of presidential power? Hasn't every president sought to use his authority to the fullest to achieve both his political goals and his private ambitions? James Thurber has spent a professional lifetime studying the uses and abuses of presidential power. Director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies and Professor of Government at American University in Washington, D.C., Professor Thurber has written numerous books and articles on presidential power. He's also served as a legislative analyst to several members of the U.S. Senate and House. James Thurber joins us now from the studios of ABC Radio in Washington, D.C.
I think we should be very worried with respect to the power of the president, but also unlimited powers of Congress. This is a period of time where Congress has ceded power to the president in their ability to declare war, in my opinion. Congress has also ceded power to the president with respect to their legislative agenda, and they've weakened their oversight of the executive tremendously. They've given the president and administrative officials really unchecked authority. I think it's unique in the history of the presidency.
Philip Cooper, a Portland State University law professor who studies executive power, says that there's no question that this administration has been involved in a very carefully thought out, systematic process of expanding presidential power at the expense of the other branches of government. Do you feel that it has indeed been a well-planned effort, or is this more of a spontaneous kind of pattern?
I think that it's planned, and I think it was planned by the Vice President of the United States, and he has basically said that. He felt that the presidency had lost power since Vietnam, and that he wanted to reestablish the power of the president. There are many people who argue that it hasn't lost power. In fact, it's expanded power during that period, but he doesn't believe that.
Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court Justice, gave a speech in the winter of 2006 in which she warned of the danger of a dictatorship. She said, to avoid these endings, we must avoid these beginnings. Were you surprised that she would say such a thing? And what do you think of the fact that she did?
I was surprised that she stood up and said that. And it had an impact. And I think that she meant that we are giving way too much power to the president on these issues that we've talked about, unchecked wiretapping, domestic spying. We've had, I think, suppression of dissent around these things, and I think that's what she was addressing. I think that the major impact of this president beyond certain issues like the deficit, the war, and certain domestic programs that he has successfully implemented will be his impact on the judiciary. It will last for a generation or two. And the Democrats that are more moderate or liberal or progressive have failed to stop it. And I think that will continue.
Impeachment has always been seen as the ultimate escape clause for dictatorship or incompetence in the executive branch. Do you think that given what President Bush has done, that first of all, impeachment is a viable option, or do you think that it's too much of a trauma for the country to go through again?
I think that impeachment is not a viable option. I think that strategically the Democrats have agreed that that is not the route that they should go. I think that the power of Congress, if it's a Democratic Congress, through oversight hearings, rigorous oversight hearings and investigations, not for the purpose of impeachment, but for looking at how laws are being implemented, will be the route of the Democrats to limit the power of the president. Remember, the president is not very powerful right now in terms of the polls. Many members of his own party are running away from him at this point, but that still leaves his power of commander-in-chief in power over whether our brave warriors will continue to go to Iraq and die. That's a very powerful thing. Congress does have the right, and if they have a change in party, they may indeed focus on trying to withdraw from Iraq more quickly, as was the case in Vietnam. I don't think they'll do it through impeachment. I think they'll try to do it in other ways.
You know, one person we spoke to a year or so ago used the expression walking away from the king. He said, there are times when you can't challenge the king directly, but you can walk away from the king and start a different conversation somewhere else with one another and with those who want to move on to a different destination. Are we now connected in other ways that make it possible for there to be other centers of power besides the executive and, for that matter, even Congress?
I think people are running away from the king right now. He's a sinking ship at this point in terms of his political power, and they're running away from him. We have many institutions in America that have limited the power of the president and pushed Congress in a particular way or limited the power of Congress. We have a pluralist system with over 140,000 associations that are actively involved in public advocacy. We have 1 million organizations in America. Totally, we have probably 100,000 people in the lobbying industry in Washington, D.C., but every community also has people that are actively involved in a variety of policies that the president's also involved in, and that limits his power or gives him more power. My concern about civil society is that, yes, we have well-organized groups, but we have what I call hyper-pluralism, extreme pluralism, where we've got many very strong groups that are powerful enough to check each other so you can't really move ahead. When that happens, when you have deadlock, it makes it hard to have policy, and it, to a certain extent, it gives more power to the president because he can, especially if the president is trying to stop certain policies.
We interviewed Helen Thomas, the journalist, now for Hearst, formerly for UPI, And I asked her whether she thought the American political system had the resiliency to be able to rebalance itself, no matter how, to what extremes it appears to go. And she was quite convinced that the pendulum will swing back and that the American people and various institutions will and in fact are already beginning to reassert themselves. Do you have that much confidence in the American system that it will find its way back to some sort of balance?
I'm sort of a radical centrist, and what I mean by that is I think that this system has a way of coming back to a centrality of where people are in terms of their attitudes and their behaviors, and that means that it's swinging back. I think it's beginning, even among Republicans that are very concerned about the power of this president. And I think it will adjust. And the way we adjust things in America is through elections. But the problem with the House of Representatives and elections is it's safer than the Politburo in Havana these days. It had seven incumbents that lost last time, four of them in a redistricting in Texas. It's redistricted to safe. There's only one seat in California that was competitive. We need more competition. That means we need reform. We need significant reform in the way we draw our lines. I don't see that happening. If we don't change the way we elect people and we have such strong incumbency, yes, there will be change, but the change will be slower than if you had more competition in the general election.
Sean Wilentz, a historian at Princeton, wrote an article in which he asserted that looking at American history, George Bush is the what he called the worst president in American history. What's your evaluation of sort of worst presidents?
I think this president ranks very low. I think that he's going to have a major negative impact through very large debt and deficit, through almost unilateral action in Iraq. His father had 34 nations. He had three nations, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and England. That's supposed to be a joke.
It took me a moment.
No, back to the point. I'm sorry, I'm drifting. I had to get the joke in. He has done serious damage from my perspective on the fabric of international relations as a result of this action. I can't think of a major domestic act that has worked that will be associated with this president. If you look at what he has done, it's not that significant compared to FDR or back to George Washington or Kennedy or LBJ or Clinton.
American University presidential scholar James Thurber. In the 230 years since the founding of the American experiment, presidents have often been tempted to abuse their power, engaging in secret wars, going to war without congressional authorization, attempting to pack the Supreme Court, spying on private citizens for personal advantage or political gain. Some have been discovered and stopped, and in one case forced to resign. Others have finished their terms without being censured for their conduct. Yet despite such examples of egregious overreaching, the American system of checks and balances has thus far survived, battered but not altogether broken, into the 21st century. Till now, a certain self-balancing political mechanism has always prevented the ultimate slide into authoritarian rule. But that's no reason for complacency. As no lesser authority than Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's monstrous minister of propaganda, warned 60 years ago, "All a leader must do to assume absolute authority is frighten his people into submission with the specter of an implacably hostile enemy." In the end, even the checks and balances within a constitutional system of a divided government may fail if there's not also a vigilant and independent press asking impertinent but essential questions, and a public awake and aware enough to exercise its responsibilities and insist on its individual and collective rights. After years of slumber, the American media and public appear to be stirring. Whether we'll waken soon enough and deeply enough to decisively reassert the rule of law over the rule of men will determine the future of an ever-fragile democratic experiment. For our greatest enemy may well not be foreign adversaries, but a fear-driven concentration of power within our own unchecked executive. I'm Mark Sommer, and this has been A World of Possibilities. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to A World of Possibilities. For more information on today's topic, click on the listener action link at aworldofpossibilities.com. This program was produced and edited by Chuck Rogers, Tim Silva, Tammy Ray Scott, and Malia Mulder-Wallen. Production engineer is Chuck Johnson. Special thanks to Mike Foley in Columbus and Kristen Espeland in Laramie. Support for this program is provided by the Ford Foundation. Music is courtesy of Sony Music Entertainment, Putumayo World Music, EMI, Alexis Hart, V2 Records, ATO Records, LaFace Records, Capitol Records, and the U.S. Air Force Concert Band. Sound clip of President Bush, courtesy of CNN. This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network. Thank you for listening.